I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
One-time billionaire and crypto whiz Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison for stealing $8 billion from customers of his now bankrupt FTX cryptocurrency exchange. The 32-year-old told Judge Lewis Kaplan at his sentencing on Thursday that he was sorry about what happened at every stage. But the judge wasn't buying it, saying Bankman-Fried was not truly remorseful and that he perjured himself when he testified. "I've never seen a performance quite like that," Kaplan said. The judge also ordered him to forfeit $11 billion. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison, who was in the courtroom for the sentencing. Ava, set the scene for us.
So it was a packed courtroom. Sam's parents were there, Joe and Barbara, who have been there for most of his court appearances. They were sitting together in the front row. There was also a victim of FTX. He gave a statement to the court on behalf of many other victims who had lost money when FTX collapsed at the end of November 2022. Other than that, there was a lot of press there. Sam was wearing a beige prison-issued uniform. He looked a lot slimmer than he used to, having spent the past 7 or 8 months in prison in Brooklyn. He didn't really look back at his parents or engage with anyone in the public gallery.
Bankman-Fried's attorney, Mark Mukasey, wrote this sort of impassioned plea for leniency, saying that Bankman-Fried should serve no more than 6.5 years in prison. What was Mukasey's argument like at the sentencing?
It was definitely impassioned. You could hear a pin drop in the courtroom when he was talking to the judge and really trying to paint a picture of a man who was largely misunderstood but had been painted as a villain, as a financial serial killer over the past almost 2 years. He provided the court a bit of an insight into the struggles that Sam Bankman-Fried has faced throughout his life, that he's always been socially awkward, he struggled to fit in, faced bouts of depression, referred to a journal entry he made once saying that he doesn't feel happiness or pleasure at all and feels like that there is a hole in his brain. He even referred to comments that Sam's own mother made saying that there is a terrific sadness at her son's core. Mukasey said that he found that quite crushing and really sort of jarred with the perception that we've got of Sam Bankman-Fried from the government as this very calculated, cunning fraudster who went out to steal billions of dollars from customers and enrich himself and expand his business empire. And at a couple of points during Mukasey's address, Sam Bankman-Fried appeared to become a little bit emotional. He was looking down at the table, fidgeting. At one point, he wiped his nose and he was blinking quite a lot when Mukasey was talking about his parents and talking about Sam's brother and talking about some of the struggles that he had in his life to fit in.
And the prosecutors had argued for a 40 to 50 year prison sentence.
Yes. So right after Mukasey finished that impassioned address, Nick Rose, one of the assistant U.S. attorneys, stood up and countered that straight out of the gate. He said that Sam Bankman-Fried knew what he was doing was wrong. He was focused and obsessed with power and influence. He gave a lot of money to different political parties because he wanted to be influential. He wanted to grow his business empire, and he was willing to use other people's money to do it. So there were definitely two different sides of Sam Bankman-Fried that were portrayed in the courtroom.
And then Bankman-Fried spoke for about 20 minutes. Tell us how he came across.
He started by talking about how he had let down the people that he built FTX with and had let down the customers. He said that, today isn't about him and the hypothetical children he may not be able to have because he's in prison in the future, but this was about the customers who had lost a lot of money. Then he circled back to a lot of the arguments that he has made in the past about customers being able to recover their money. He doubled down on claims that there was always enough money to repay creditors and FTX could have kept going if it was allowed to. Yes, Alameda Research, a sister hedge fund, would have folded, but FTX would have been okay and customers would have been okay as well. He also took a few digs at the bankruptcy estate and the new administrators of FTX. This was an argument that didn't go well during his testimony and sort of left the judge at least feeling like he wasn't showing any remorse. He was admitting that, yes, he'd made mistakes, he'd made a bad bet, but he wasn't ready to admit to wrongdoing.
Reading what the judge said in sentencing him, it sounded very stern and just unrelenting.
Yes, Judge Kaplan listened to everything that Sam had said and that his defense lawyer had said, but in the end, he was pretty stern in his characterization of Sam. He said that he had committed some very serious crimes here and there was a real risk that he could offend again. Yes, he was brilliant and he was intelligent and he had a great mathematical mind, but on the flip side, that also put him at danger of reoffending again, because if something appeared to be a good bet and there was a likelihood that it might succeed, then that motivated him and encouraged him to do certain things. So Judge Kaplan said that he wanted to hand down a sentence that would potentially prevent him from doing that again for a very long time and deter others from committing similar crimes.
So how did Bankman-Fried react when he heard 25 years?
He didn't react at all. He was standing up between his lawyers at the table. He had his hands clasped in front of him and he was either gazing down at the table or just looking towards the judge. You could see as the judge was handing down the sentence and lining up different years and periods with the different offences that Sam seemed to be trying to do the calculations in his head, like his eyes were darting around the room. But in the end, when Judge Kaplan said that the total sentence was 300 months, Sam certainly didn't seem surprised. I think he had been bracing himself for this moment for a very, very long time. And to him, 20 years is the same as 40 years.
Quite a day in court. Thanks for taking us inside the courtroom, Ava. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny-Morrison. Joining me now to analyze the sentence is former federal prosecutor Michael Weinstein, a partner at Cole Shots. 25 years. Was this a harsh sentence, a fair sentence? How would you characterize it?
Well, it's pretty much down the middle. It's a pretty even sentence based upon the amount of loss here, based upon the judge's conclusion that he misled the jury during his testimony and the type of impact he had on victims.
So we talked about the risks of SBF testifying as far as the jury verdict, but not the risks as far as the sentencing. And his testimony came back to haunt him. Judge Kaplan increased the sentencing guidelines range after finding that SBF had perjured himself at his trial. And he said, when he wasn't outright lying, he was often evasive, hair-splitting, dodging questions. I've never seen a performance quite like that.
Yes, that's pretty remarkable for a federal judge to say that about a defendant who testified. To put it bluntly, you know, his testimony was a calamity during the trial, and it's a catastrophe after trial and for sentencing.
He found that SBF had committed witness tampering before he was remanded into custody when he communicated with the former FTX general counsel. Is that a stretch? It always seemed to me like there was room for different interpretations there.
Well, look, if you're a defense attorney, you want to argue that there was no witness tampering and that, you know, what he did doesn't qualify under the federal statutes for such. But as a prosecutor and as a judge, when a defendant does reach out for or send signals out to witnesses or potential witnesses, that's very concerning. And I think that's how the judge viewed it, is that Sam Bankman-Fried just overstepped the line in trying to communicate with or sending signals to witnesses. And that's a no-no, especially in a judge who's this experienced and have seen those things go very badly.
Bankman-Fried's defense attorney made this impassioned plea for a lenient sentence, but the judge didn't buy any of his reasons, including his contention that the victims would be repaid in the bankruptcy.
I think that the judge concluded essentially the thought that there was a victimless crime, which is what the defense is trying to argue, was both misleading, flawed, and speculative. And so I think the defense did the best they could with the hand that they were dealt. And certainly the defense lawyer, very talented, very eloquent, very experienced on his feet, just didn't have the facts and didn't have the client that could really be appealable to this judge. And this judge has been sitting for a very long time, I think 29 or 30 years. So he's seen enough and heard enough and observed enough to be able to cut through a lawyer's arguments, as good as they may be, and really get to the heart of the issue, which is what he did here, and that's why he put him away for 25 years.
So SBF said in his statement to the judge, "I'm sorry about what happened at every stage. It haunts me every day." But the judge said that he lacked real remorse. If SBF had said more, could that have hurt his appeal?
It potentially could. I think that SBF still hasn't come to grips with what he did and how he did it. The judge certainly doesn't think that he has taken full responsibility for his actions. And, you know, SBF is going to have a long time to reflect upon that.
He said he intends to appeal the sentence and the conviction. What would be the grounds for appealing the sentence? Is it unusual to see a sentence like that knocked down?
It is. If the calculation, for example, that the judge used was inaccurate, or if the case law or the cases or the factual provisions and basis that the judge used was inaccurate, or, for example, there was something in the pre-sentence report which was inaccurate, all of those things are reasons why you would challenge a sentence. But obviously, you're dealing with a very experienced judge. You're dealing with a high-profile case. So in all likelihood, a challenge of the sentence is likely to not be successful.
How much of this sentence was about setting an example and warning about crypto and the financial markets?
Look, I mean, anytime you have a situation like this with such high publicity, you have to step back and say the prosecutor brought this case not only because a crime occurred, but also brought the case to send a signal to the crypto industry because, you know, government regulators have become very concerned that it's just the Wild West and they had to rein it in to a certain degree. And I think by extension, the judge felt as though he had some obligation as well to clarify that even in the Wild West of crypto, there are boundaries, there are guardrails that you cannot cross, and fraud is one of them. And as a result of that, that's why he sentenced them to what he did.
The judge made a lot of rulings that limited Bankman-Fried's defense. For example, preventing expert witnesses from testifying. I assume that that's going to be part of the appeal. If it is, how difficult is it to get a reversal based on those kinds of decisions by a trial judge?
So the trial judge is going to have broad discretion, and the appellate court is going to look at whether or not what he did was so manifestly improper, and it would have had some material impact on the trial. And those are two very high burdens, very high hurdles to cross over to have the conviction overthrown. I just don't see it happening. You have very able counsel on both sides, both on the government side and on the defense side, pre-trial related to those motions. And you have a judge who obviously seriously and thoughtfully considered those arguments and then made the decisions he did. So I think the appeal generally is an uphill battle.
Finally, so you have the three cooperators who turned against SBF and pleaded guilty to their roles and testified. They are coming up for sentencing now. Looking at his 25-year sentence, is it likely that they'll get a stiff sentence, or could they walk away without any prison time?
So I don't foresee them walking away without some sentence. They certainly would not get decades in prison as Sam Bankman-Fried did. I think, number one, they came out early and agreed to plead guilty. Number two, they gave cooperating information and cooperated in testimony. And number three, they provided essentially the blueprint for what occurred. And that gave the government the ability to go after Sam Bankman-Fried in the trial and triangulate against him so that he was really boxed in at that point. He really was, you know, the 800-pound gorilla that they needed and they convicted and they want to put in jail. The others are equally important, just not as important. And they will have a harsh sentence, but it's certainly not going to be anywhere close to what he just got.
It's going to be very interesting to see what Judge Kaplan sentences them to. Thanks so much, Michael. That's Michael Weinstein of Cole Shots. Coming up next, the Supreme Court appears likely to back access to the abortion pill. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This week, the Supreme Court took up the divisive issue of abortion for the first time since overturning the constitutional right to abortion in 2022. But even most of the conservative justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade appeared wary of the legal attack on mifepristone, a drug now used in more than half of the country's abortions. Justices from across the ideological spectrum were skeptical that the anti-abortion doctors challenging the FDA's loosening of regulations for mifepristone had standing or suffered the direct harm needed for them to bring the lawsuit. Here are Justices Ketanji Brown Jackson and Brett Kavanaugh.
I mean, it makes perfect sense for the individual doctors to seek an exemption. But as I understand it, they already have that. And so what they're asking for here is that in order to prevent them from possibly ever having to do these kinds of procedures, everyone else should be prevented from getting access to this medication.
Just to confirm on the standing issue, under federal law, no doctors can be forced against their consciences to perform or assist in an abortion, correct?
Joining me is reproductive rights expert Mary Ziegler, a professor at the UC Davis School of Law.
Mary, just about everyone who listened to the oral arguments is of the opinion that a majority of the justices will turn away this challenge to mifepristone. Is that your opinion as well?
Yeah, it is. I think that it seemed that most of the justices were convinced that the plaintiffs in the case didn't have standing.
Before we talk about standing, tell us about the merits argument the anti-abortion doctors were making.
The argument, at least, that the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, the plaintiffs wanted to make, was twofold, right? One, that the FDA didn't have the authority either to approve mifepristone back in 2000 or to lift subsequent restrictions on the drug in 2016 or 2021. The argument being that the FDA hadn't been careful enough with the science to make all of those decisions. And there was a related argument on the 2021 changes, which are what permitted abortion for reasons of telehealth. Their activists argued that the Federal Comstock Act, which is a 19th century obscenity statute, prohibited the mailing of abortion-related items, so the FDA couldn't have had the authority to approve telehealth because doing so would have violated federal law. So those were a lot of the arguments that in theory the court could consider. We don't imagine they'll be in a majority opinion because we think the plaintiffs will likely be held not to have standing. But some of those arguments seem to capture the interests of some of the conservative justices for down the road.
Abortion opponents have looked at the Comstock Act as, you know, a possible way to stop medication abortions. Do you think that that is a fight that will happen down the road?
It might. I mean, so in this case, you know, if these plaintiffs don't have standing, other plaintiffs could. We know that at least on the Comstock Act front that both Justices Thomas and Alito signaled some interest in the idea that the Comstock Act bans mailing abortion pills and maybe other abortion-related items as well. So I think, you know, whatever comes out of this case may not be a final resolution.
So, as you said, the justices from across the ideological spectrum expressed doubt that the doctors and the organizations had standing to try to overturn the FDA changes. What do you think was the heart of that argument?
The plaintiff's argument essentially was a speculative argument, right? So they said there are complications that inevitably ensue when people take mifepristone. And some percentage of those people with complications will end up in the emergency room. And then they said it's reasonable to assume that some of those patients might end up in our emergency rooms, and it may be the case that we have to treat them. And then that may cause us a conscience-based injury. The problem with that, according to many of the justices, was, one, none of that may happen. Right? This is all just possibilities. And two, that it seemed that there was a mismatch, as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson put it, between the remedy the plaintiffs were seeking and the harm they suffered. She and Justice Gorsuch asked, you know, if the problem here is that doctors may have to act against their conscience, why can't those doctors just get a conscience-based objection? Why do they have to go all the way to taking a drug potentially off the market for all Americans? So there were clearly problems with standing from the beginning, and that's why we saw it being such a focal point at the argument.
So Justice Brett Kavanaugh asked only one question in the 90-minute argument. And he said, just to confirm on the standing issue, under federal law, no doctors can be forced against their consciences to perform or assist in an abortion, correct? He asked the Solicitor General.
It's unusual for a justice to ask only one question during these long oral arguments. Do you think he was trying to deflect attention away from himself when there's been so much discussion of his concurrence in the Dobbs case?
I think Kavanaugh just thought this was an easy case. I mean, I think there was a signal that, you know, these doctors, if they had conscience-based harms, they weren't going to be forced to do anything they didn't want to do because they already had protections under federal law. And that made the kinds of injury they were talking about even more speculative. I don't think, you know, a lot of the justices seem to think this was an easy case. And I think Kavanaugh may have been more unplugged from the argument for that reason.
Now, there was also a claim, we talked about the claims of the doctors, the for organizational standing. And Justice Alina Kagan said, you need a person. Who's your person? Did the organizational standing claim fall even worse than the claim of the doctors?
I think so. I mean, I think even Justice Thomas seemed doubtful about the organizational standing claim, suggesting that it just proved way too much. So the argument that the organization had made was that it was expanding resources and time to fight mifepristone that it would have liked to use on other pro-life work. And several of the justices, again, including Justice Thomas, who you would think would have been one of the most sympathetic to the plaintiffs, said, well, if that's true, then put in any social movement group, bring any lawsuit and say simply the fact of the lawsuit was an expense of resources they wouldn't otherwise need to bring. And that gives them standing. So there was arguably even more skepticism of that claim than the one involving the doctors.
Justice Gorsuch really tore into the fact that a nationwide injunction was issued here. Let's listen to what he said.
We've had, one might call it a rash, of universal injunctions or vacatures. And this case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action.
The justices have complained before about these nationwide injunctions, but yet they don't do anything about them. Might they in this case?
It's possible. I mean, clearly Justice Gorsuch would like that to happen. You know, I think there was sort of a soapbox moment where this has been a pet peeve of his, and he took an opportunity to hold this case up as an example of what's wrong with universal injunctions. I don't know if that's going to be too far afield from the issues at hand, given that this ruling is likely to center on standing. Justice Gorsuch may write separately to complain about universal injunctions. I don't know if the majority is going to do anything in this case. I'd be sort of surprised if they did.
So, Mary, if, as everyone thinks, they take the off-ramp and rule there's no standing here, I mean, does that leave the question open for other groups to try to challenge mifepristone?
It potentially does. So we know that in the trial court, several conservative states have sought to intervene. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed this case to proceed without joining those cases or those parties to the present matter, but they are before Judge Kaczmarek. If they don't end up having standing, it's not hard to imagine that other conservatives will try to assert it. General Prelogger alluded to the possibility that, you know, she thought those other parties don't have standing either. And that was a point Justice Alito wanted to make a big deal about, essentially to say, well, if these people don't have standing, if nobody has standing, isn't that a problem? But I don't think we know at this point that the court would rule out other people potentially having standing.
The anti-abortion doctors brought this case before a sympathetic, very conservative Texas judge, Trump appointee Matthew Kaczmarek, and that meant the appeal went to the most conservative circuit court in the country. Do you think that the new policy to curb judge shopping might have stopped this case from being brought before Kaczmarek?
It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I would hope. We have to see, I think, how those changes play out in practice. That's certainly the outcome they're designed to achieve. But I guess I would say we'll have to wait and see how they work in practice.
And something like 8 states have been stockpiling mifepristone in the event that the Supreme Court ruled against the FDA here.
Yeah, they have. And they've been also stockpiling misoprostol, another drug that would be used as an alternative. You know, so mifepristone and misoprostol are used together now in medication abortions. Misoprostol on its own can also be used to produce a medication abortion. So there's a possibility that that would also occur.
The Supreme Court is going to hear another abortion case in April over Idaho's total ban on all abortions, except when necessary to save the mother's life. The Biden administration had sued, arguing that hospitals that get Medicare funds are required by federal law to provide emergency care, potentially including abortion, no matter if there's a state law banning abortion or not. Why do you think the justices took that case?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's likely they don't agree with the Biden administration's interpretation of the law. They've let Idaho's ban, which has some of the narrowest exceptions in the nation, stand while the litigation continues. I think they clearly think that there's something wrong with what the Biden administration is doing. The interesting question is what? Is that they think that this statute simply has nothing to do with abortion, or that they think it's likely that the language of the statute, which refers to an unborn child, actually limits in some ways what doctors potentially even in blue states could do. So I'm not sure which of those possibilities we'll see.
Will that case be more of a test of the Dobbs decision than the Mifepristone case is?
Yeah, it definitely will, in the sense that we're much more likely to see a ruling on the actual merits of the question rather than a decision on standing, which, I mean, obviously it's important that the court still recognizes guardrails on who can sue, but it doesn't give us much of a sense of the substance of abortion law post-Dobbs in the same way that this other case could.
With all the controversial cases the court has this term, including those involving Donald Trump, is it surprising that the justices are taking up two cases involving the divisive issue of abortion in a year when abortion is basically going to be on the ballot?
It is. I mean, I think, you know, we already know that the court has had problems with its reputation since the Dobbs decision. And we also know that the court in Dobbs itself essentially proclaimed a lack of concern about those issues, right? Essentially said, if people don't like this and they don't like what we're doing, they can kind of stuff it. It's not our job to care about that. We're not concerned about that. And taking two abortion cases in a term, which is very unusual. I mean, before Dobbs, the court would often not take an abortion case more than, you know, sometimes once a decade. So having two in one term was pretty exceptional. So I think it shows you that the court is not worried about the damage that's been done to its reputation and is ready to continue full steam ahead.
Well, we'll find out how these cases come out by June. Thanks so much, Mary. That's Professor Mary Ziegler of UC Davis Law School. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, Donald Trump's win-loss record in court this week. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
I'm very rich. I built an unbelievable company.
All my life, I made money. I made money. I've always been good making money. I have made billions of dollars in business-making deals.
Donald Trump loves to brag about how much money he has, and the former president is in fact richer than ever. His social media company debuted in trading this week, and the former president's net worth soared to $7.2 billion. But when Trump faced a deadline on Monday to either pay the full $454 million civil fraud verdict against him or post a standard bond for 120% of the judgment, or risk having New York State start seizing his assets, the billionaire said he didn't have the cash to cover it and claimed he'd have to sell properties at a loss to raise the cash. Trump was saved from having to make that decision when a New York appeals court handed him a financial lifeline and cut the bond by about two-thirds to $175 million.
So I greatly respect the decision of the appellate division, and I'll post either $175 million in cash or bonds or security or whatever is necessary very quickly within the 10 days.
But Trump's financial strains are far from over as he faces four criminal trials. And on Monday, a Manhattan judge refused to throw the hush money case out or delay the trial further, ruling that Trump's first criminal trial will start on April 15th.
I don't know how you can have a trial that's going on right in the middle of an election. Not fair. Not fair.
Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Eric Larson, who's been following these cases and rulings. For the first time, Trump is joining the ranks of the world's wealthiest 500 people on the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. How did he get there?
Well, the short answer is that his media company, Trump Media and Technology Group, is now a publicly traded company through a merger with a special purpose acquisition company or a blank check company. This had been a long time in the making. It really soared after it went public and more than doubled his net wealth, at least on paper. He had been at around $3 billion, and now he's over $7 billion.
So, Eric, you say on paper, and despite this new level of wealth for him, he said he couldn't make the bond.
So the problem for Trump in court this year so far has been cash. He lost that defamation trial with E. Jean Carroll and had an $83.3 million damage award. He had to post a bond to put that on hold while he appeals. That bond was over $91 million. And then, of course, shortly after that, he got hit with a $454 million penalty in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case that she won in trial. And he was facing the prospect of posting a 120% bond in that case in order to put that verdict on hold while he appealed. And that would have been a bond around $550 million. He got a big reprieve, though, from the New York Appeals Court, which lowered the bond in that case to just $175 million. He said he's going to pay that with cash. He needs to do that by April 4th to put that on hold while he appeals. But before the Appeals Court lowered that bond, he was saying in court filings that he did not have enough liquidity to cover both these two big bonds, plus have reserve to run his company. So notwithstanding everything happening with Trump Media, he was in a position where he did not have enough cash to pay that bond just recently.
So the appeals court cut his bond by 68%. Do we know why they decided to do that?
We don't. The court issued that decision granting Trump's motion to lower the bond without saying why. It didn't give any indication at all. So we're just kind of left wondering. Obviously, there's a range of reasons why the court might have taken this action, anywhere from simply having mercy on Trump to let him post still a significant bond of $175 million. While challenging the verdict and the penalty in that case. You know, there were no specific victims in this trial, so it's not as if there are, you know, individuals out there waiting and concerned about getting their money back. Although the Attorney General, Letitia James, she did say that she did not trust that Trump would pay the penalty if it were upheld on appeal, that he should be forced to pay the full amount of the bond to put it on hold while he appeals. So, you know, the other argument that some people have said is that the appeals court may be somewhat skeptical of the huge damage award in that case. I mean, perhaps that's the reason they were comfortable lowering the bond. But again, that's just speculation on both sides. We don't have any specific reason why it was lowered.
On Truth Social, he said on Sunday, "Keep your hands off Trump Tower." So he continues with this relentless push for donations from his supporters. Well, at the same time, bragging about how wealthy he is.
Right. So Trump has used tens of millions of dollars donated to his reelection campaign to cover his legal bills. He can't use that to pay damage awards in these civil cases that he's dealing with. But clearly his legal fees, he's facing four significant criminal prosecutions on top of these two civil cases. So he's really been racking up the fees and spending a lot of his campaign money on that. His campaign is being far outpaced in fundraising by President Joe Biden's reelection campaign. So really, you know, every dollar would seem to count in terms of trying to reach voters with his donated campaign money. But instead, Trump is using a lot of it to pay his legal bills. And on top of that, his fundraising is falling behind. So, you know, you have to juxtapose the fact that we have a billionaire, even before Trump Media started trading. Now he's, you know, estimated to be worth $7 billion or more or less. And he's still asking individuals to send him $5, $10, $20 to help him with his campaign, which, of course, a lot of that will go to his legal bill. So it's an interesting dynamic, to say the least.
Now, on Monday, he got the good news from the New York Appeals Court about the bond, but bad news from Manhattan Judge Juan Merchan that there would be no further delays in the hush money trial, and it would start on April 15th. It was supposed to start in March. Explain why there was this delay.
Sure. Yeah, that trial was originally supposed to start March 25th, and instead it was delayed several weeks, and there was actually a hearing on March 25th instead, and that is when the judge set the April 15th trial date. But the reason that it was delayed is because there had been a late production of tens of thousands of pages of documents related to the case handed over by federal prosecutors. Of course, this is the Manhattan District Attorney's case, but there was a related federal case in Manhattan, an investigation into Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, who, of course, several years ago pleaded guilty to various campaign finance crimes related to his work for Trump. And, of course, Cohen is going to be a star witness in this upcoming case. And so Trump's defense wanted to get a look at everything related to that federal case to see if there was anything in those documents that could help them with their defense. So they raised a huge fuss about this production. And even the Manhattan DA said, yes, a 30-day delay is warranted because of this being handed over. But Bragg, the district attorney, accused Trump and his lawyers of wildly exaggerating the significance of these documents and, by the way, requesting them from the federal prosecutors months and months later than they could have. So I think for the prosecutors, it's not like a last-minute delay tactic that has been sort of cooked up here. And frankly, the judge seemed to see it that way, too. At that hearing, the judge, Juan Merchan, really laid into Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche. He's a former federal prosecutor, and said, you waited months. You requested subpoena these documents in January. You could have subpoenaed them in June, July last year. And also, there had been a previous hearing in the case just back in February where Trump's defense had argued for a delay of the trial, but never mentioned that they were waiting, apparently, for all these documents to be handed over. So the judge was pretty annoyed and said that he sort of expected better from a former federal prosecutor.
And Trump's lawyers were claiming that this was prosecutorial misconduct?
The judge disregarded this issue, said that it wasn't prosecutorial misconduct, which is what the defense alleged. And in fact, he shot that down so hard, the judge was really annoyed that they even brought it up because it's such a serious allegation to make. And they just kind of threw it around based on this document being handed over late. The judge said, you haven't provided any evidence to suggest misconduct whatsoever, and yet you make this serious allegation. The judge was very upset by that, and as I said, declined to delay the trial further and set the trial date.
On Tuesday, the judge issued a gag order in the case that had been requested by the DA. Who does that gag order cover?
So the gag order prevents Trump or anyone at his direction from publicly commenting about the prosecutors or potential witnesses or the jurors during this trial. So this was requested by the district attorney, and the judge granted it based on Trump's history of conduct around this type of behavior in regards to talking about judges and prosecutors and jurors and even family members. So the judge said that he balanced carefully the First Amendment rights of the former president against the fair administration of justice and determined that in order to protect everyone involved, given Trump's platform and his millions of followers, that he needed to be restricted in this way. This, of course, does not prevent Trump from denying the allegations and saying, you know, a lot of other things about his rivals and the witch hunts and everything else like that. It's targeted at preventing personal attacks that could put people's safety at risk. You know, even one of the criminal cases against Trump in Washington, of course, accuses him of inciting a deadly insurrection at the United States Capitol as part of his plan to overturn the result of the 2020 election. So there's quite a bit of evidence that Trump's words have impact, and the judge does not want to take any chances here, especially after we saw in the two civil trials that Trump does have a hard time with his filter in court. He was kicked out of both trials. He clashed with the judge. He muttered under his breath and had to be warned repeatedly about saying things that the jury could hear. So this is just the judge's way of trying to prevent any of that from happening in his courtroom, and we'll see how effective it is.
The gag order did not cover the judge or his family, and already in a social media post on Wednesday, Trump attacked the judge for rejecting his request to delay the trial and for imposing the gag order. And Trump apparently cited a bogus social media account to make a false claim that the judge's daughter had posted an image of him behind bars. There's a lot going on here, and the trial hasn't even started. Thanks so much, Eric. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Eric Larson. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.